loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the Saudi purge continues to sow chaos across the Middle East as the kingdom declares that Lebanon has declared war against it, and President Donald Trump endorses the sweeping crackdown on opponents of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Next, speaking in South Korea, where he met today with President Moon Jae-in, Donald Trump repeated his standard threats but also surprised many by floating the possibility of negotiations with North Korea. What is Trump's strategy in Korea? And finally, it's Election Day in the United States, and the most closely watched campaign is the race for governor in Virginia. Ralph Northam is the favorite, but a late surge by Republican Ed Gillespie threatens to deal another demoralizing blow to the Democrats. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear.
But first we turn to the situation in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi purge continues to sow chaos across the region. We're joined from Beirut by independent political analyst Marwa Osman. And we are joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. Welcome, Marwa and Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Marwa, let's start with you. Give us just a summary of where we stand right now. The events are moving so quickly. What's going on in Saudi Arabia and how has that affected Lebanon?
Well, and actually, the news about Lebanon began before, just hours before the news that we started hearing about the purge that's going on in Saudi Arabia by bin Salman against his cousins. What happened is on Friday, our Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, was summoned back to Saudi Arabia within 1 week. Actually, after 24 hours after he landed back in Beirut, at the beginning of the week, he had a meeting in Riyadh. It was something normal. He went back to Beirut for 1 day. He had several meetings with several regional diplomats. And then 24 hours later, he was summoned back to Saudi Arabia with a fast track. I mean, they wanted him like right now. We didn't know what happened. We just knew that he went. And once he arrived there, we just had the resignation on Saturday. Suddenly, there was a video that is being, it's a recorded video that's being broadcasted by Al Arabiya channel, which is the official TV channel of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. On that recorded video was our Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri, the Lebanese Prime Minister, giving out his resignation using terminology that we have never heard him use before. He might have used something similar before, but not this kind of terminology that we literally hear every time from a different Saudi king. So it's apparent that he didn't even have a say in what's written in there. I'm not sure. I'm just saying what we have analyzed. And I'm not sure because we haven't heard of him anymore. This is what everyone watched the same video, and that's it. He just made one phone call to the Lebanese president, President Michel Aoun, informing him of this decision after the broadcast, actually, which was a very shocking experience for everyone, for both the people who are within his political party and for others who are even against his political party. But for every Lebanese on this planet was shocked because if you go back to the last couple of months, even the last couple of weeks, everything was not violet and pink roses, obviously, but it was going well. And it was going well according to his statements. It's not according to me saying so. It was a shocking experience for everyone. And what happened later on made it even more shocking because no one got hold of him anymore. No one could know where he is. No one can talk to him. He was not receiving his messages. People were trying to send him messages and phone calls and even WhatsApp messages. He was not receiving any. He was not talking to anyone for several days up until today. I'll talk what happened today, but let us go back to what happened after that. Just hours after this happened, we started reading headlines saying that bin Salman has ordered the arrest of 11 very important princes, Saudi princes, and more than 20 senior figures alongside all their assistants and et cetera, people, the people who are surrounding them, the trusted people by them. Everyone was arrested, and the big prison was the Ritz-Carlton. And we knew about the Ritz-Carlton because the Ritz-Carlton actually threw out all the guests. They politely asked the guests to leave because they now no longer are allowed to have any because it's being used by the kingdom. crown prince as a prison to put the arrested princes and senior figures in. And then the analysis started happening that what if Saad al-Hariri is there? I mean, if someone as important as Al-Walid bin Talal, if you don't know who Al-Walid, I'm not saying you, if you in general don't know who Al-Walid bin Talal is, then you don't really know what a Saudi prince is, what a Saudi prince with money and with the power to change economies is. So as a personality, not only him, there were many personalities that are very important figures that were arrested. But let's take example as Al-Walid bin Talal, whose net worth is more than $18 billion. If that man was arrested like that in Saudi Arabia, then what happened to our prime minister? And if our prime minister is no longer, quote unquote, the prime minister of Lebanon, which leads to me saying that now he's going to be treated as a Saudi citizen, because what people don't know is that Saad al-Hariri actually has the Saudi passport. He has another nationality, which is the Saudi nationality, which means now if he's no longer an official of another country, they can not only detain him, they can imprison him as well. So that we started analyzing this, and with us not being able to get in contact with him, made things even worse. And then what happened later on, late night on Sunday, was the fact that he tweeted, the account of Saad al-Hariri, the prime minister, tweeted a photo of him with one of the princes who were getting newly appointed in the position of one of the other princes who got arrested. So he tweeted a photo with that prince. And just when we double-checked, it was so easy, you know, with the technology we have today, we just double-checked the rooms available at the Ritz-Carlton, and they perfectly fit with the background and the furniture that are found in Saad al-Hariri's tweet, the photo. So now things are getting even weirder.
Oh, boy. And
later on, what happened I think it was yesterday, we saw a video of him meeting with King Salman, supposedly in the Yamama Palace in Riyadh. But just a bit of research, you don't need to be an expert, a bit of research into the Saudi daily newspapers where every day they write what happened with the activities of the king, you see that the king is actually having certain events in Jeddah. So it is quite impossible for him to be meeting with Saad al-Hariri, which means that this video is an old one, which also gets us into another theory that, again, where is our prime minister? Now, what happened today lately is our prime minister there was a photo out that he went to the Emirates, to the United Arab Emirates, and he met with the Sheikh of Al-Imarat, of the Emirates. We still don't know if he actually went there or it was the other way around. We're just getting information from the media of Al Saud. So we don't have any confirmed information here. And then he was supposedly going to visit Bahrain, but suddenly, I don't know what happened. The schedule changed again and he's back in Riyadh. So no one has talked to him. We can't handle anything that is going on in the media because we cannot get any credible information. And at the same time, you have terrorizing, crazy news coming out of Saudi Arabia with princes having their planes downed. At first, we thought it was an accident, but later on, Haaretz today issued a huge report saying it was actually downed by Saudi jet planes, by warplanes. So apparently this prince who died was trying to flee the country towards Yemen. And then we have another report about another bin Fahd prince who is also that he died yesterday because of the wounds that he incurred on the first day, which is on Saturday, because of an exchange of fire with the so-called, quote-unquote, the black water, which is being used by Saudi Arabia, by the Saudi Arabian authorities. So princes are dying. Princes are being detained. Our prime minister is somehow, we don't know why, but somehow got caught in the middle of all of this. And to end off with the most epic with the most epic episode of the craziness of Al Saud, we have Thamer Sabhan, which is the the Minister of Gulf Affairs, who's spewing all sorts of rhetoric and warmongering ideas and thoughts across media against Lebanon. He comes out late yesterday night and says that now Saudi Arabia is at a state of war with Lebanon because the Lebanese government is refusing to let go of Hezbollah. I mean, is he actually aware of what he is saying? He wants to take out more than half of the population because he just wants to. So it's really complicated. But at the end of the day, it's Al Saud. I mean, we don't understand half the things that are happening, but this is their way of doing it.
Ambassador Peter Ford, every one of these points is an important point. I'm one of many, many Saudi watchers in Washington. I've been following Saudi Arabia for 28 years now, first at the Central Intelligence Agency, later at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I can honestly tell you, I have never seen anything like this coming out of Saudi Arabia. Marwa Osman is exactly right. We're seeing purges, arrests. Prince Abdulaziz bin Fahd was shot and apparently killed while resisting arrest. We're seeing detentions of princes, ministers, court officials, and the earlier detention and deposition of Prince Mohammed bin Nayef as crown prince, probably the most popular Saudi prince in all of the Western world. And then couple that with a helicopter crash that killed the deputy minister of Asir province, the Saad al-Hariri resignation, the missile attack on Riyadh airport that probably was not committed by the Houthi rebels. What in the world is going on in Saudi Arabia? And do you think this is inching the Saudis, or maybe not even inching, but pushing the Saudis closer to a military confrontation with Iran, for whom they blame practically everything?
Well, Saudi Arabia is certainly acting out of character right now under the impulsion of this young, hot-headed crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He's obviously been making a power grab in recent months, and things were brought to a head in the last several days, particularly by the elimination of the head of the National Guard, which was very important in terms of state security, internal security. Now, Mohammed bin Salman has all the reins of power in his inexperienced hands. And this inexperience is showing through in the field of foreign affairs as well as domestic. He has been instrumental in carrying forward the brutal and failing war in Yemen, in taking absurd initiatives against Qatar, which have achieved nothing, and now in apparently seeking greater confrontation with Iran. The Saudis, having lost out in Syria and losing out in Iraq and Yemen, appear to be looking for a new battlefield, namely Lebanon, where they think they have more cards to play. But in this too, I think they will be disappointed.
Well, let me ask you about that. I want to get back to this apparent missile attack. Defense experts here in Washington are saying that the Houthi rebels they're not even rebels, they run the government now, but the Houthis in Yemen do not have the capability to launch a missile all the way from Yemen to Riyadh airport. And the speculation, at least in Washington, is that the Saudis launched this missile on themselves, intercepted it, and then, of course, blamed the Iranians. If you couple that with the political events in Lebanon, it's sort of, you sort of come to the same conclusion that you just made, that the Saudis believe that they can take on the Iranians more easily in Lebanon than they can directly. Is this a way to confront the Iranians and then perhaps ask the United States to step in for help?
Well, it does look as though they're trying to build up military tension with Iran and now declaring that Lebanon is in a state of war with Saudi Arabia. If it wasn't so bizarre and grotesque, it would be funny. Again, under the leadership of this young man, the Saudis have started to behave in ways that can only be described as manic, as unhinged. And this is obviously very dangerous. However, Lebanon, I'm confident, will pull through this latest crisis. The Saudis have tried to exercise muscle in Lebanon before, notably 10 years ago. There was a power play and they were seen off quite quickly because Hezbollah has the military clout in Lebanon enough to guarantee the stability of that country.
Marwa Osman, there were also reports today that President Hadi of Yemen is under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. President Hadi is, you know, effectively the ruler of South Yemen. The Houthis control the north. And it seems like there's these two parallel efforts going on. There's one effort by the Saudi government to discipline its allies and proxies in the region where, Hariri in Lebanon, Hadi in Yemen, they're, you know, not doing what they're supposed to be doing or not performing to the level that the Saudis want them to perform. And then internally, they're purging their domestic opponents, the domestic opponents of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Do you see it that way as these two parallel but conjoined efforts?
Well, the thing is, it's not. But how, you want to look at how Mohammed bin Salman has been trying to maneuver around all the not traditions, but all the operations that are taking place or were taking place inside the kingdom and outside the kingdom that are directly related to it. Starting with the coup he made at the beginning of the summer against bin Nayef, and then going into opening up more, or in a way that is not new, but in a way that it is extravagant and maybe a bit exaggerated alongside Donald Trump by issuing a lot of plans or promises, both for the U.S. alongside a lot of money that was paid for certain projects to be implemented that were not able to be implemented using the norms of proxy wars, like the proxy war in Yemen or the proxy war in Syria. And he was making a lot of promises to enhance or develop the interior economic cycle inside of Saudi Arabia itself, with the promises of his 2030 plan that up until now seems a lot near impossible to implement with all these things that are going on. Now, if you go and look at what happened to the Saudi project in Syria, then look at what happened in the Saudi project in with Qatar, against Qatar, then the Saudi project in Yemen, and literally every foreign project that they have invested in to try and affect the decision-making process inside of the country, and hence put their hand even firmer on the resources of that country and on the decision-making, on political decision-making process, you see that it has been a complete failure. And I don't think that bin Salman likes failure. I think... to be honest, I've been reading a lot about him, but I still cannot just pinpoint what kind of a personality he holds within, because I think he's a bit too young to actually have one. But at the same time, so he's inexperienced and he's trying to make some change and as fast as possible without taking into consideration what repercussions might come from those changes. And add to that the steadfastness of the Ansarullah, or what is known in the mainstream media as the Houthis, but it's actually the Ansarullah because it's many tribes, not only the Houthi tribe. So add to that the steadfastness of these tribes and their ability to not only resist, but also to retake parts of the land which are officially Saudi, but historically part of the Yemeni state. They were able to retake those back and they were able to hit. And I don't think, to be honest with you, I don't think the theory of Saudi Arabia hitting itself is true, because if Ansarullah issued a statement, then they issued a statement. They're not going to lie about it. And they do have Burkhan 2H. So I think that they did actually do this, and they literally, with a very specific and detailed statement, they said, we deliberately targeted the airport, but the railway, the runway, and not the actual airport, because they don't want to kill any civilians. At the end of the day, they are a religious resistance, so they have certain limits. I would argue if it's a good, like, I would argue with you if it's a good target or not, but that's not the case here. The case is that they were able to use this kind of technology on the international airport of Saudi Arabia in the midst of the purge. That made bin Salman just go crazy. And we have been seeing what the repercussions of that move was. He literally went crazy. It has been massacre after the other for the past 48 hours. If you see the number of deaths, if you see where he's bombing, it would. I literally dropped and cried today. I couldn't handle the images that I was receiving from Yemen. Since Sunday, it has not been allowed for planes with aids to land. the ships are no longer allowed to dock in the ports of Yemen. People are now getting more shortage of resources and of medical aid and of medical supplies. It's just horrific. It's just beyond a genocide. It's no longer just a genocide. It's a genocide and an apartheid and whatever you want to call it. It just fits Yemen right now. So he went crazy because he wants change fast. He wants it right now, just like a little kid. He wants the candy now, and he wants everyone to abide by his new rules. And he wants to see very fast changes because he wants to tell the world, look, I am fit to be the next prince, the next king, and you can trust me, and I'm going to bring change. I'm going to change the Wahhabi ideology. I'm going to change this and that. But apparently no one told him that there's something called resistance to change, whether in the foreign policy or especially in the interior policy. And resistance to change comes from the leaders of those groups who will resist the change. And what he is doing is provoking the public by arresting their leaders, hence poking their resistance to change even more. So I don't really see how far Mohammed bin Salman's plan can go further. But what I can see is definitely now we are in a phase where there is no return and that anything that comes next is going to be catastrophic.
You know, that's a very important point. Ambassador Ford, the Al Saud family, since the consolidation of its power in Saudi Arabia in the early part of the 20th century, has relied on family consensus to govern. And whenever a king dies and a crown prince becomes king, the family meets, the family council meets and approves that that transition. And of course, it approves of a new crown prince. There was not consensus when Mohammed bin Salman replaced Mohammed bin Nayef earlier this year as crown prince. And now we see Mohammed bin Salman removing the very long-standing heads of the Saudi National Guard and the Ministry of Defense. Now, Mohammed bin Salman has taken over control of the Ministry of Defense, but only just in the last few days has the head of the Saudi National Guard been arrested. So my question then to you is, how could Mohammed bin Salman maintain control of internal security forces, keep himself safe, if there is not a family consensus on his leadership, and he does not necessarily have control of internal security apparatuses in the kingdom?
Well, I think you have to reread the Godfather book to understand what's going on here. Really, it's a very good template. Things have not always been sweetness and light within the Al Saud. King Faisal was assassinated by a cousin, and King Saud was pushed into exile. It's a very mafia-like family behavior. But the current young Don seems to be taking things to a new extreme. He already held in his hands before this latest mini coup most of the reins of coercive power, the military armed forces and the forces of the interior ministry and the Mukhabarat, the secret service. But now he appears to hold the reins of the National Guard, which was the remaining center of power that might have moved against him. The situation there is a bit opaque, but I would guess that the leadership of the National Guard is currently being changed, and that everything will end up in the hands of Mohammed bin Salman.
You know, the funny thing too, Walter, is in the event that Mohammed bin Salman is able to consolidate authority in Saudi Arabia, the guy's only 32 years old. I mean, we could be looking at a 50-year-long reign, and he could transform Saudi Arabia and make it, what he called earlier this week, into a liberal or more moderate, I think were his words, a more moderate Muslim state. Or he could push Saudi Arabia right into war with Iran, as he has with Yemen. He could launch a war against Qatar, which I think would be disastrous because nobody would follow him into it. I wonder what we're looking at here, not just over the next 50 years, but over the next year or 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that he could pursue is, you know, perhaps even a formal alliance with Israel. I mean, Saudi Arabia and Israel has so many convergent interests in the region. In Syria, of course, both are longstanding opponents of the Syrian government. You know, on Iran, that's the main thing. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman seems absolutely obsessed with Iran, going so far as to blockade one of Saudi Arabia's, I mean, traditional allies, Qatar, over alleged links of relations with Iran. In Yemen, I mean, there's of course the Houthis are not pro-Israel, right? And Saudi Arabia is bombing them. So there's this clear convergence of interests, I think. And Saudi Arabia, of course, has this traditional stance as being opposed to Zionism, but that's sort of a relic of the past, I think, in the eyes of a lot of Saudi policymakers. So, you know, will they be able to weather public opinion, which is, you know, of course, entirely opposed to Israel and its treatment of Palestine? I don't know, but that could be one of the big picture projects that you can pursue over, you know, the course of what could be a very prolonged reign.
Marwa Osman, we have about a minute and a half left. Please take us out with your thoughts. What are we looking at in the coming months, in the coming year?
Well, let us just wait and see what will happen until the end of this year. But it's really hard to talk. I'm that serious. I mean, if you look at what happened in the past 48 hours, it's like cuckoo land.
It's crazy. It is. It's unlike anything I've ever seen.
Exactly. And then you have rhetoric all around, people wanting to bomb Iran and wanting to bomb Hezbollah and then wanting to end Hamas and then wanting to take Bashar al-Assad out of his. It's just, I don't know what's going on. I'll be very honest. I literally don't know what is going on. But what I can say from the past analysis of what has been going on for the past 7 years in the Middle East, that the project that is funded by Al Saud, promoted by the U.S. and pushed by Israel in the Middle East has fallen. And what I mean by saying it has fallen, I mean that Iraq has kicked ISIS out. Syria is now as we speak, Abu Kamal is being raided by the SAA and the allies of Hezbollah and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They're going to take Abu Kamal. And if they do, that will be also ISIS out of Syria. We just have the northeastern part of Homs with a bit of Nusra there. And we have Idlib. So it's basically ended. It's done in Syria. Yemen has been 2.5 years and it's not working. So the entire project is falling apart. It has fallen apart, to be exact. And again, what we're seeing in Palestine with the new reconciliation amongst the Palestinians is also some sort of a threat to the existence of the Zionist entity. Not that much, but I mean, it still is. And so you just look at this and then you see how much rhetoric and hate, literal hate, I don't know what you can call it other than hate, against Iran and its allies in the region, even Turkey. They're now talking against Turkey. So all of this hate and the feud against Qatar, and all of this is literally one trying to light a fire around himself and then say that only us are safe and everyone else will get it. Everyone else will get killed. This is not how you run countries. This is not how you do diplomacy. So I don't know what will happen, but it's not going to be good.
I think you're right. This is something that absolutely bears watching. Marwa Osman joining us from Lebanon, Ambassador Peter Ford joining us from London. Thank you so much for being with us. This is Loud and Clear, and we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Speaking in South Korea, where he met today with President Moon Jae-in, Donald Trump repeated his standard threats, but also surprised many by floating the possibility of negotiations with the North. What is Trump's strategy in Korea? We're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun, a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Professor Chun, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So tell me, what in the world are we supposed to make of Donald Trump's comments? From one side of his mouth, he talks about the inevitability of war with North Korea. And then from the other side of his mouth, he talks about the possibility of a negotiated settlement. All the while, we have three carrier battle groups headed toward the North Korean coast. What do we make of this?
Yes, indeed. He just said that something like it really makes sense for North Korea to come to the table and make a deal. And also, he confirmed that there has been some kind of a diplomatic effort between North Korea and the United States by saying that he said, I do, quoting his words, I do see some movement, although he did not specify that. And also he reduced a little bit of his intense rhetoric that he had for the last few months. I think this is a little bit of relief, but I think that he is, my analysis, that he's just responding to President Moon, who really, really wanted to assure to Korean people that any anxiety. I think the President Moon Jae-in specifically asked Trump that, his visit can relieve some of South Korea's anxiety over not only the threat in the Korean Peninsula in general, but also, his own very high-style rhetoric, although President Moon did not use that word. I think Trump is just showing his small, adequate manner. But I do not see any evidence of Trump's shifting his earlier policy. As you mentioned, there are still major three nuclear powered U.S. Aircraft carriers have conducted joint military exercise with Korea, and I do not see any development that suggests otherwise. If anything happened, it is Trump's moderate response is in responding to the massive, anti-Trump, anti-war, peace movement that Koreans and also Americans and Korean Americans have engaged, and also senators and U.S. lawmakers who have tried to really, ask Trump to restrain his hostile threat.
Let's try to break this down. You raise so many good points. For our listeners, let's try and figure out what exactly is behind Trump's change in rhetoric. Now, on the one hand, Trump has entertained the Chinese leadership here in the United States. And then at the same time, he's criticized China, and he has stated publicly that China is the U.S.'s greatest strategic foe in the coming years. At the same time, he's clearly reliant on China to try to rein in the North Koreans. With that said, the South Koreans are the ones urging Trump to go to the negotiating table with the North, because in the event of war, who is going to suffer more than the South Koreans? And then on the way out to Asia, the Japanese have made comments that they support Trump's policy in the Koreas and are standing by, willing to help with whatever it is the U.S. government asks them to do. This is not necessarily all good for diplomacy. Do you think that there really is a chance for diplomacy? You quoted Trump's statement that I'm seeing here in Reuters, where he said he urged North Korea to, quote, do the right thing, and added that, quote, I do see some movement, although he declined to elaborate. Movement where? The only place where the U.S. is in direct contact with the North Koreans is at the United Nations, and we haven't been in direct contact recently at the United Nations.
Yeah, I would like to point out some major diplomacy that has been going on. First, as you recall, Russia has offered to mediate between North Korea and United States. That has been reported on media. North Korea declined. North Korea refused to come to the table. And the second interesting diplomatic effort that I wanted to point out that, China and South Korea has been somewhat of, strained because of U.S. deployment, as I said, in Korea. And just last week or so, China and South Korea, the current Indian government, had reached a major compromise, and Indian government said they're not going to deploy additional SAT launchers there. So it looks like China and South Korea has really restored somebody's trend of diplomacy. Thirdly, so I think looking at this flurry of diplomacy, and here comes Trump, who has been for months and going on the very, threatening rhetoric. And I think that Trump is seeing an opportunity. Maybe if he doesn't do anything, he will kind of miss the opportunity out. Maybe the China or Russia might actually be, making progress with solving this situation, and they may get credit So again, this is my total just a personal analysis, and not just looking at Trump's words alone. And so here we may see the something that we don't know yet. We may see some windows of opportunity that Trump is trying to seize. So before, you know, China or Russia does anything, maybe he will, United States maybe get proactive and getting something out of that means which is deal. And here, here comes then, South Korea, Moon Jae-in. As you know, President Moon Jae-in has been very, very actually with the 150% with the United States and Trump praising and everything. And so, he's trying to get some, trust from President Trump. So in other words, South Korea is really relying on or supporting U.S. attempt to implement any diplomacy with North Korea. So to make the search, to make my point, what I see is that, although I'm not sure it is clear, but I think that Trump might try to explore a small window of opportunity, not because he wants it, but because of all this sort of competition. But I could be wrong.
We're talking with Simone Chun. She is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korea Peace Network. Professor Chun, I want to take it back to Korean domestic politics for a second. President Moon Jae-in was probably very pleased. He was probably very pleasantly surprised by Trump's tone and, you know, what he actually said. Moon Jae-in was a top aide to former President Kim Dae-jung, who initiated the Sunshine policy of engagement with the North, of dialogue and engagement with the North, and limited economic cooperation. The military, however, has a very different orientation in South Korean politics. Talk about the institutional power of the armed forces. I mean, they governed the country, they ruled the country in a dictatorial manner until the 1980s. Are there forces that would seek to sabotage any type of rapprochement, even, you know, the very beginnings of dialogue negotiations with the North over the nuclear issue or any other issue?
Yeah, that I think that is the biggest obstacle right now. And, you know, that that was so evident under previously the impeached President Park Geun-hye. And even I recall that even Park Geun-hye tried to sort of some diplomacy with North Korea, but every step of the way, these military hardliners and really stopped it. And even the National Security Advisor, you know, for President has gone, and he really obstructed all the, you know, major, you know, these elected politicians who wanted to diplomacy with North Korea. So with this huge, huge military establishment that aligned with America's Pentagon's interests, America's military-industrial interests, complex interests, America's all the weapons exporters' interests, and they are right now the biggest sort of barriers in the Korean Peninsula. The only difference right now is, as you know, Moon Jae-in received more than 73.3% approval rating, and 80% of more than 80% of Koreans want diplomacy and a peace with North Korea. And also right now, the very new sector that is, you know, in Americans, right, the bipartisan support, more than 80% of Americans, talking Democrat, they also do not work in the Korean Peninsula. So it's as you saw, the very first visit that Trump did was, you know, the America's largest peacetime construction came Humphrey, as you saw, right? As you can see that this is South Korea. It almost gives this sort of impression of a U.S. major military, the biggest military base and almost U.S. colony. And what it says is it's really the interest between within South Korea and United States over the U.S. military base or U.S. military-industrial complex is so deeply, deeply, deeply rooted that that is the single biggest factor. But again, you know, Korea is West still is a sort of it's evolving democracy, and the biggest hope will be, in fact, the people who, or 80% of people who can actually contest these military establishments. But you are absolutely right,
Professor Simone Chun. North Korea has not conducted a missile test for 53 days now. That's the longest lull in testing so far this year. And the North Korean state media, interestingly enough, has not even commented on the fact that Trump has arrived in South Korea. What do you think the chances are of the North Koreans initiating a missile test launch just to challenge Trump? I know that there's been talk at the White House of the efficacy of intercepting a missile launch. But then, of course, the United States runs the risk of a propaganda failure by actually missing the missile. So what do you think the North Koreans are going to eventually do in light of the fact that Trump is in the South and he's talking about war with North Korea?
I do not think that North Korea will do anything while Trump is in Asia. I mean, that's just my own guess. But however, I do not exclude the possibility that North Korea will do another some kind of testing of ballistic missile. As you know, North Korea is really North Korea. If you look at North Korea, is very very predictable. North Korea is looking for very credible, very genuine and sincere diplomatic gesture from the United States and also, of course, all, even including the six parties. And if right now, I think if really, truly, whether it's informally or if a very formal diplomatic channel, the United States shows a very clear sign for diplomacy. I think that there won't be, as you said, there has not been any North Korea testing of a ballistic missile for the last, really, for a long time, 53 days. You won't see any testing. But I think probably this is time that Trump can do, especially United States can do something, especially, you know, Trump will be meeting leaders in China and also attending APEC. So I have a very, very small hope for that.
Yeah, we have just about a minute left. Let's stick with that. You know, Donald Trump will be going to China afterwards. China just had its big party Congress. There's been a bit of a rapprochement between South Korea and China, which, you know, relations had soured really, really quite badly because of the installation of the U.S. THAAD missile system in the South, which has radar that can penetrate deep into China. What do you think will happen in China, and what are the implications for Korea?
I think that the biggest issue we really have to look at, whether no matter what China or regardless of what China, United States, the big picture is geopolitical politics is that U.S. confrontation with, let's say, North Korea is just one component of a very broad strategy that is aimed against still, you know, the remaining Cold War, that is China, Russia, or any power that at the present threatens the global hegemony of American interests. So here, I think that if China and United States can reconcile all of these conflicting interests, that will really also help the current crisis in the Korean Peninsula. So, finally, what I want to say is that as an activist, I still believe that the main actors, the key actors that will bring major progress is not really Trump or Chinese leader or Russia or even for them and Moon Jae-in. These are actually the most emerging, most powerful, the top peace movement, solidarity between Koreans and also Korean-Americans, Americans. And I have not seen such a powerful movement for the last 20 years. I think that the reason why actually, the reason why Trump didn't show any reconciliation or any sort of gesture for diplomacy as responses to this massive, massive peace activist effort, which, as you know, I myself involved, you know, behind the scene, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people and hundreds of organizations that are involved. So I think that there is a hope.
Well, thank you very much. That has to be the last word. Professor Simone Chun, who is joining us from Seattle. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarik.
It is Election Day in the United States, and the most closely watched campaign in the country is the race for the governor's office in Virginia. Ralph Northam is the favorite, but a late surge by Republican nominee Ed Gillespie threatens to deal yet another demoralizing blow to the Democrats. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, totally anecdotal, but I went to my local polling station this morning at 7:15 to vote, and I was the only person in the building. I have voted at the same time, 7:15 a.m., in previous elections, and I've had to stand in line for an hour and 15 minutes, waiting for my turn. That can't be good for the Democrats.
I presume not. I think it sounds very bad, but we shall see.
The latest polls being posted on RealClearPolitics.com consistently have Northam ahead, but not by much. And most of these polls fall within the margin of error. We've got Northam by 2, by 5, by 9, by 1, 6, 3, 3, 1, and 5. So that shows a very tight race. My question for you, though, is that Virginia over the last three cycles or four cycles has actually been much closer than the polls have shown. Some pundits in Washington are saying that this is Northam's race to lose. Other pundits are saying that he's probably already lost it. What do you think?
I just don't know. I mean, if you're coming to me for magic crystal ball gazing, you have the wrong guy. But I'll tell you, I think the polls generally are slightly biased in the Democratic direction, and that turnout is really the hard thing to gauge. We just don't know, and a low turnout hurts Democrats. High turnout will benefit them. And your story about the empty polling place this morning is not very encouraging from a Democratic point of view. But, you know, but the whole day lies before us, and we'll see what happens. But I'll tell you one thing. If this is a very important race, it's a bellwether for the 2018 congressional elections, and whoever wins or loses is going to be, a whole lot is riding on the outcomes of that.
And this is actually more than just the governor's race. Walter, we spoke yesterday about down-ballot races, especially in the state legislature. The Republicans control both the state House and the state Senate. No state Senate seats are up for re-election this year, but the state House is competitive, and the Democrats are targeting something like 26 districts in which Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump, but are represented by Republicans. The Democrats will tell you privately that they don't expect to win more than 10 or 11 of those seats. But at the same time, you know, it's the state legislature that redraws district boundaries based on the national census. And if the Democrats are serious about recapturing the House in a year or three or five, they're going to have to start winning these down ballot races.
Yeah, and these down ballot races are, you know, this is where the Republicans prevailed, beginning in around 2010, where they did their long march through the state legislatures, captured, you know, state house after state house, and then were able to redraw the congressional districting map to give themselves what I figure is roughly a 5% built-in advantage in house races. So there's a lot riding on this in that respect, but there's a lot riding on this in broader ideological terms. I mean, this is a referendum about Trump and Trumpism, whether we mentioned the Donald's name or not. And we'll see whether the Democrats are beginning their recovery or whether the Republicans still have the momentum on their side.
Daniel, can you tell our audience a little bit more about Ed Gillespie? I mean, I think one of the things that makes this such such a high stakes thing, maybe more for the Democrats than the Republicans, is, you know, not only, you know, what John was saying about how state governments are essential to redrawing district maps, but also because Ed Gillespie is such, I mean, I think like a pathetic candidate. I mean, he's such like a classic establishment party operative that if you know, the Democrats aren't able to beat somebody like that in a state that they've historically had a slight advantage in, then, you know, like, what are they even doing? What do you think about that? And who is Ed Gillespie? What's some of his background?
I think you're right. I mean, Gillespie is like a consummate insider. He's a northerner. He's from New Jersey. He was a lobbyist for years in Washington, D.C. He's a consummate insider. In this race, he has, you know, he's looked at all the weather forecasts, and he has redrawn his appeal. He faced a very stiff conservative challenge in the primary, which he beat out only by shifting decidedly to the right. And now he's mounting a classic, you know, Trumpist campaign against Northam, you know, playing up the anti-immigrant angle, the Southern Confederate monument angle, you know, the question of parole for sex offenders, all these hot button, right wing issues that he's just like, you know, really employing to the max. So we'll see if it works. But Northam, of course, is a very weak candidate. He has flip-flopped repeatedly on just about every issue. I don't think there's a single tough issue that's come his way that he has not somehow reversed himself on. You know, Confederate monuments, immigration, you name it, he has done a flip-flop. So he is the classic centrist Democratic weak one. So if he loses, it'll be a big boost for the Sanders-wing Democrats who will say, you just can't win with, you can't beat something with nothing. But if he wins, that'll be a boost for the Hillaryites who will argue that the good, solid, traditional centrist approach is the one that can and will prevail.
Daniel, Ed Gillespie has spent millions and millions of dollars on television ads. You can't watch TV for more than 120 seconds and not see a Gillespie for governor ad. But none of those ads mentioned Donald Trump. If Gillespie wins, or even if he just comes close to winning, is that a blueprint for other Republicans next year in the congressional elections to run on these right wing hot button issues, but not mention Donald Trump?
So it'll be Trumpism without Trump. That's possible. Trump's kind of a crazy guy in the White House. He rattles the cage a great deal. So the Republicans, want to avoid all the bad publicity that goes along with supporting Trump. But Trump has got some very solid support. That's one thing that seems to be pretty clearly established. And one by one, the Republicans have fallen into line behind him. So guys like Gillespie in a purple state like Virginia, are striving for some kind of non-Trump, Trumpist message. But I think that elsewhere, I wouldn't be so worried. If I was Donald, I wouldn't be so worried about how things stand for him personally.
You know, you make an important point, too. I wanted to talk very briefly about southwestern Virginia, which has been historically Democratic, more heavily union than the rest of the state, and in recent years has been carried very easily by Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. Although a year ago, Mark Warner almost lost his election because Ed Gillespie, then running against him for the Senate, was able to break even in southwestern Virginia. Do you think this is a trend? Are Democrats losing populist-leaning union members? And if so, what does that mean for elections next year for Congress?
Well, I think they have been losing them. They're trying to reverse them. The question is how to reverse that trend. Is it the centrist approach that will work, or the Sanders approach? And that's what this election is about. If Northam wins, then Tom Perez will be doing a victory dance at the DNC headquarters, Tom Perez being the very centrist Democratic chairman. But if Northam loses, then you'll see Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and scads of their supporters, coming out and saying, "I told you so," and that the centrist strategy is just not working. Remember, Northam, had to fight off a pro-Sanders challenger in the primary, and
Tom Perriello.
He only did it by attacking to the bits of the left. So there's a curious parallelism between him and Gillespie. Gillespie had faced a right wing challenger. Northam faced a left wing challenger, and each candidate rejiggered modified their course accordingly.
Walter, we've got a situation here where the Democrats have nominated their lieutenant governor, Ralph Northam, who has been a conservative most of his life. He has been very open about having voted for George W. Bush twice, and he is the standard bearer for the Democratic Party in Virginia, having beaten Tom Perriello, a liberal congressman formerly from Western Virginia. If this race doesn't work out for him, what's that say about moderate or conservative Democrats elsewhere in the country as we approach the midterms next year?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the logic of lesser evilism, right, where you look at politics not as this dynamic thing, but as a static set of options. And so, you know, you just have to look at what's available and pick the one that is the least bad. And I think that, you know, assuming that voters will consistently do that is basically why, you know, centrist Democrats aren't able to win elections very well, why Hillary Clinton wasn't able to win the election. Because, you know, in that circumstance, you know, wing of the political establishment that is in motion, that isn't just sort of, you know, picking the less of all options is the right wing, right? I mean, we can see how, you know, politics in this country have gone, you know, considerably to the right. You know, we've mentioned on this show a lot of times that Richard Nixon was for universal health care. He was for the Equal Rights Amendment for women. He was for, I believe, forgiving student loan debt. So, you know, when you have this logic where we're just going to accept the options that are given to us and choose the one that we hate the least, then that means you lose the initiative, you lose the dynamism in politics. And so you get people like Ralph Northam being the standard bearer for the left in politics in Virginia.
You know, we spoke yesterday on this program about the issues in the Virginia governor's race. And the issues are immigration, for example, and sanctuary cities and issues that really are not. They're not intellectually honest. There are no sanctuary cities in Virginia. And it's ridiculous to say that one candidate or the other is pro MS-13, a notorious violent gang. But the Republicans have been successful in framing the debate in this state. Is this not a lesson for other Republican candidates to frame the debates in their states or in their districts and make it easier for themselves to tackle Democrats?
If it works, John, it is, unquestionably. No, but to be fair, you know, it was the Democrats or Northam supporters who put up that crazy pickup truck ad.
Yes,
which showed a black and Latino and a Muslim, you know, Muslim kids running in terror from some guy with a Ed Gillespie bumper sticker on his truck. You know, and that was just so ham-fisted.
And the only person who can save them, according to this ad, is Northam.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. That was Daniel Lazard joining us from New York. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, and remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.